Welcome to the Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm pleased to host today a discussion on the geopolitics of the Green Deal. Geopolitics of the Green Deal is a big discussion. It is really a discussion about what foreign policy implications the European Green Deal has. And we are launching actually a paper and publish a paper in which we discuss exactly the various mechanisms by which Europe's major economic policy endeavor to green our economy and make it carbon neutral by 2050. So we outline the channels through which this green transition is affecting neighboring countries as well as the globe. And in the paper, we also discuss then what kind of foreign policy agenda should be derived from exactly that discussion. And so with me today are three of my colleagues with whom we have worked on this paper. I'm pleased to welcome Simone Tagliapietra, who's a research fellow at Bruegel, Jeremy Shapiro, who is the research director at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And let me emphasize here that we worked with the European Council on Foreign Relations for this project, as well as Jean Pisani-Ferry, who is a senior fellow here at Bruegel and also a senior fellow at various other institutions in the world. And the idea really of this podcast is to introduce the paper and first walk you through some of the key ideas, key conclusions of the paper, and then engage in a discussion on a few of the most critical points. But let me turn first to Simone to introduce to our listeners the four main channels that we have identified in our research, the channels through which the European Green Deal affects the rest of the world.
Thank you very much, Guntram. This paper, we indeed want to look into what are the channels through which the European Green Deal can have its geopolitical implications. We are convinced that by redefining the European economy, the European Green Deal will really also change relations between the EU and its neighborhood, and will also redefine Europe's global policy priorities. Think about how the European energy mix will be changed by the European Green Deal. Today, almost three quarters of the European energy system relies on fossil fuels, oil and gas. This situation will be upturned by 2050. If you look at the projections about the imports of oil and gas into the European Union, after 2030, there will be a major drop in both the imports of oil and gas, down 80% and 70% respectively compared to 2015. And that will inevitably have major repercussions globally. Now, what are these repercussions? We identify in the paper four main channels through which these repercussions will occur. The first are the repercussions for oil and gas producing countries in the EU neighborhood. There are countries around the EU, like Russia, like Nigeria, like Libya, and many others, that are highly dependent on the oil trend and that are highly dependent on Europe as a unique, almost in certain cases, export market. The European Green Deal will thus significantly affect not only the fiscal situation and macroeconomic balance of these countries, but also really the social contract in these countries. And this is really something important, notably, as we will see, for a country like Algeria. The second channel is the repercussions for the European energy security. The European Green Deal, by slashing Europe oil and gas imports, will solve what has been traditionally the major energy security concern, oil and gas security of supply in Europe, but will also pave the way for new risks. Such as the dependency on the imports of renewable electricity or the imports of green hydrogen, again, from the neighborhood and notably from North America. The third channel relates to the repercussions on global energy markets. Europe represents 25% of the global oil market, and therefore the disappearing of Europe, notably after 2030, from the global oil market might really have depressing effects on the global oil price, with serious repercussions for producers, notably for the ones that have a higher break-even production price. Think about Nigeria. Fourth, and this is the last channel we identify, we see repercussions on global trade. And this is really the case if the EU is to introduce carbon border adjustment measures, as this commission is committed to do, and in the spring we will already see some proposals with that regard. Those are the four channels we identified.
Thank you, Simone. That was very clear. So four major channels that can be easily identified by economists as having repercussions on the rest of the world. Now, the question is, what kind of repercussions will that entail at a more geopolitical level? And for that, I want to turn to Jeremy to give us a sense of what it all means geopolitically for the various countries affected. And before we then move to a discussion of what we think the EU should implement in terms of policies. Jeremy, over to you.
Thanks, Gunther, and thanks for having me. Look, as usual in geopolitics, we know it means a lot, but we don't know exactly what. So I'll try to take you through some of the essence of it. You know, it's very clear that the Green Deal is foreign policy, whether it recognizes it itself as that or not. I mean, the EU is only 10% of global emissions. If you're actually going to reduce carbon emissions significantly, you need to use the Green Deal as leverage to do that. And I think even more directly, it's going to affect other countries whether you want it to or not, and they're going to respond. And so we wanted to understand how other countries are going to be affected and how they will respond. So we looked at sort of five of the most important countries. First, in the sort of neighborhood of Europe, the ones that would be affected by the first two channels that Simone mentioned, which is Russia and Algeria. And, you know, these two countries are deeply dependent on the European energy market. They export a vast majority of their fossil fuels to Europe, and they get a huge amount of their government budget and GDP from those exports. And so they're going to be dramatically affected if the Green Deal goes ahead as anticipated. So Europe really has both a responsibility and a need to try to figure out how to help them with energy transition if it's going to realize these goals without destabilizing those economies. And it needs to take something else into account, which is going to be very, very difficult, which is that these are, like many oil and gas producing states, very much rentier states, which means that the government depends on these oil and gas revenues and the nature of oil and gas revenues, which is that they sort of come up from the ground and are very easily controllable by the state to sustain the regimes. And so they're going to resist diversification, even though they recognize that it's necessary. And we can see that very strongly in both Russia and Algeria.
Jeremy, on this point, because I think it's a very interesting, and just to interrupt a bit and zoom in a bit on the various points. So the neighborhood countries that are directly rentier states, as you call it, Russia, Algeria, there are some others, they will be affected by this. But the paper also says quite clearly it's not an immediate thing, because in the next 5 to 10 years, Europe will probably still import a lot of the natural gas that it currently imports, perhaps even import less. So Russia will only be affected really by this after 2030, when the major transition happens away from natural gas. Also, the next 10 years, reliance will still be quite strong.
10 years is like tomorrow, Gunther.
Exactly. So we have to think about now what to do with these states. And I guess we can have an argument whether it's a good or bad thing that the rentier states don't get the money more or less for free anymore.
By and large, I'm very happy about it, I have to admit. It doesn't please me that the Algerian government is basically financing its oppression of the Algerian people through exports of energy to Europe. But we have to take into account that these countries can be quite unstable, that they are very close to Europe. And if their economies crash and their governments crash, that's not going to be good for them or for Europe. So the point is to sort of try to ease the transition, both politically and economically, which are very interrelated in these countries. To move on to the second group of states, I think we looked at the sort of global players who are mostly affected by the last two channels that Simone talked about. And this is the ones we looked at were China, the United States, and Saudi Arabia. And what's interesting about these countries is that it's very clear that there's a sort of cooperative and competitive element to the geopolitics of the Green Deal. Cooperative in that that they all recognize that climate change is a real thing, or the United States does as of 10 days ago. And they are all sort of participating in trying to reduce climate change. And they all actually have efforts that look vaguely like the European Green Deal. But they are very competitive when it comes to control of green technology into the future, investment in third countries, helping other countries make that transition, and most particularly, who is going to sort of own the standards and who is going to be the leader in climate technology and climate standardization. And so those are, you know, you could argue, and I think a lot of people do, they see climate change as a public good, and so everybody should want to participate in it. But actually, there's quite a bit of competition over who is going to pay for it and who is going to control the technology in the marketplaces. And I think that that's the principal way in which we're going to see the Green Deal actualized, particularly with China and the United States. And that includes under a Biden administration, which is much more friendly to climate change than the recently departed Trump one.
Great. I think that was setting very nicely sort of the implications for the various countries concerned. But now I want to turn to Jean to get his take really on what to do about all of this and what should be a sensible European policy agenda that will manage these implications, and that I think will also from the beginning factor these implications into our foreign policy mix. And I think one reason why we wrote this paper was really a realization that this isn't debated much. I mean, so what we debate is the Green Deal and how to become carbon neutral, but we don't debate much that this actually has implications for our neighborhood. And so thinking about what can be done and how can this be transformed into an opportunity for the globe and for Europe's role as a foreign policy actor was an important part of our reflections in that paper. But I let Jean discuss those, please.
I think you're absolutely right. The approach, you know, as far as the carbon border adjustment mechanism is concerned, certainly that's part of the discussion. We don't have a clear decision yet as regards to the precise mechanism that's going to be put in place. But certainly the issue is part of every discussion on moving to carbon neutrality in Europe if the rest of the world doesn't move at the same speed. Now, if you look at the issue of neighborhood, it's not part of the discussion. It's sort of looked at, you know, something that's simply out of the picture. And what Jeremy said, if I push what he said a little bit further, I would say maybe what we'll do inadvertently to push Russia into the arms of China. If Russia doesn't have access to the European market, it will look for diversification. It will be harder for Algeria because of the infrastructure for GNL, but certainly in terms of policy intention, it's very likely that Algeria will look for alternative markets because in principle, it's easier than to look for a complete retooling of its economy. So inadvertently, this can have very serious consequences. And so I think the first message we're giving is, look, this is not a domestic issue with minor or sectoral trade-specific international consequences. This is going to be a policy with consequences across the board. And if you're a large enough economy, you have to take care and figure out what to do about these consequences. You know, we're used to saying Europe is only 10% or less than 10% of global emissions, but Europe is 20% of the import of oil because Europe is a large part of the demand for oil globally because the US is sort of neutral, is a net exporter, actually. A number of other countries are net exporter or close to balance. Europe is a massive market because of its complete dependency for oil. And so whatever we do is going to have profound repercussions. So I think the first message is really we should be conscious of those repercussions, and this should be part of the policy agenda.
Thanks, Jean. Of course, one dimension then and one question then is what follows from this in terms of actual financial resources and funding. And we had a long discussion when we wrote the paper, and I think the paper makes a concrete proposal now. The EU is committed on its domestic agenda to use almost 600 billion funding, fresh money, to sort of engineer the green transition over the coming decade. Wouldn't it be a good investment to use a fraction of that, such as, for example, 10%, meaning 60 billion, to support green transition elsewhere, also to create really a business opportunity for European companies that are leaders in some of those technologies, but really also to ensure a more rapid decarbonization and to manage the geopolitical implications of the changing energy mix of the European Union. So I think that's a further dimension. And if I can perhaps also get Simona on the point of a security of supplies, which we haven't yet touched on, but which is, I think, a very important dimension of the Green Deal, is the fact that, you know, we will have to import different things. We will not import oil and gas as much as we do currently, but we will have to import some of the rare earths and raw materials that are needed for a green economy, for battery production. So where do we end on this debate, Simona?
Indeed, Europe after 2030 might import less and less of oil and gas, but certainly more and more of critical raw materials. Whatever we need in the low carbon technology space, being electric cars, solar panels, wind turbines, etc., all these goods require for their manufacturing a number of different minerals and metals. Now, here there are two kinds of geopolitical risks. The first relates to certain critical raw materials that are specifically located only in certain countries. Typical example, cobalt in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and only few other countries in the world. Then there are other kind of critical raw materials, such as rare earths, which are widely distributed across the globe, actually. But the processing of these minerals only happens in China for a number of different reasons. And therefore, those are two order, different order of dependencies that Europe might really, at the end of the day, be trapped on. So how to face these risks? The first is supply diversification. So whatever we can do in terms of supply diversification, we should do. And this is exactly what we have learned from the lesson of the dependency on Russia for our gas. But then there are also other things we can do. We can foster the domestic production when possible of these materials. And we can certainly work more on increasing the recycling volumes and also the substitution of these critical materials with other that are not critical. Mm-hmm. And this basically entails fostering research and innovation for the substitution and fostering the recycling in Europe.
So Jeremy, we just heard that we will become more dependent on China. How comfortable are you about that?
Yeah, I'm reasonably comfortable. First of all, we're already really dependent on China in a lot of ways, so it's not that dramatic. But more importantly, I think that the capacity to be careful about these things and to create supply diversification, I think, is great. As Simona was pointing out, I mean, you know, you need to do it, but actually there's much greater awareness of it now than there used to be. And I'll point to the sort of really interesting rare earth effort in the last 10 years. You know, China tried to use its monopoly on rare earth processing against Japan in, I think it was 2010 or 2011, when they arrested some fishermen in the East China Sea or something. And what happened is that it spurred a lot of diversification, and it really demonstrated that China's monopoly or dominance on rare earth processing was something that could go away very quickly, because it's not the same as having, you know, energy in the ground. And I think a lot of these things exist because they're cheapest and convenient to exist. But if China makes them a geopolitical issue, they can go away quite quickly. And in fact, in the last 10 years, rare earths has diversified quite a bit, in part because the Chinese want to get out of the business to a large degree, because it's incredibly dirty and it's been very polluting in specific areas of China, and local officials are keen to get away from it.
So Jean, can I push you a little bit on China and the US and what to make out of the trio European Union, China and the US? Is there scope for striking a grand bargain on climate change between the three? Should it just be the EU and the US driving the agenda and forcing China's hands? How do you see sort of on the broader picture, the energy and the climate neutrality attempts with these three powers?
We are in a new game. I mean, under the Trump administration, we had an alliance with China to keep the Paris Agreement alive. Now we have a new U.S. administration that is committed not only to joining the Paris Agreement, but actually to, you know, implementing a policy of targeting carbon neutrality and reaching it. So it changes the game, and the temptation for Europe is to sort of change tack, to move to an alliance with the US, possibly to propose a carbon coalition to the US with trade implications, so that there would be a normal trade or free trade with the US and with countries that are not serious enough about reducing emissions, there would be border adjustment mechanisms. And the question is how to treat China. And clearly, this is very much in balance at present. So what we're saying is that, yes, this opportunity of engaging the U.S. much more should be taken. The Biden administration is certainly serious about climate, but we shouldn't leave China aside and sort of move to a climate club together with the U.S., excluding China. This climate club should be open to whichever country is seriously committed to reducing its emissions. And so it's probably going to be a moment of truth for China, which is, in words, certainly committed to reducing emissions, but at the same time is opening coal-fired plants and contributing more to the warming. So I think it's going to be a difficult discussion. It has to take place. We have the COP26. We have beyond, you know, the question of when and how is the climate coalition formed. This is high stakes for the EU and for the global economy.
I think we are coming already to the end of our podcast discussing a very broad topic with many, many facets. And of course, the paper goes into quite some detail of all of these various aspects that we mentioned. Today, there's also issues we have not yet mentioned, such as thinking about other areas than just carbon border adjustment, for example, the issue of the thawing of permafrost in Siberia, which is one of the big climate risks because it would release major amounts of methane, which is a major climate gas. So there is scope also to work together and for the EU to drive a global alliance to fund measures that would slow down the thawing of permafrost. I mean, just to give another example of what are the agenda items that I think really the EU needs to discuss and the EU needs to drive. Let me give Jeremy and Simone a last word, just for one last thought, which we haven't really discussed, and then we conclude.
Sure. I wouldn't mind just coming in a little bit on something that Jean was talking about, this sort of China-US-Europe triangle, because I think it's fascinating, and in some ways it's the most critical element. And it was actually, I think, the issue which we struggled with as a group the most in writing the paper. And I think I come out in a slightly different place than Jean. I mean, the principle is all fine, of course, what he said. But the reality, to my mind, is that the Chinese, as in a lot of other areas, are big on pronouncements on climate change, are really involved at the moment in a sort of charm offensive, particularly toward Europe, on climate change, and are actually going to be very, very difficult to monitor, very, very difficult to hold to their promises. And I think very likely to essentially try to do what they've done in the trade area and in other areas of multilateral governance, which is essentially speak kind words and then do whatever they want to at home. So I think that it behooves Europe, while sure, accepting that if the Chinese do what they say they're going to do, then everything will be sweetness and light, to not expect it. And to really be working very closely with the Biden administration to try to fashion a climate club that is tough, that has standards which are very tough and which can be monitored in a very effective way. because otherwise I think we can expect to see a lot of talking the talk, but not much walking the walk. And also, I think that this has a secondary effect, which is super important, which is that, you know, the United States is the sort of in and out of climate change, depending on its government. It's the issue which most divides the parties in the United States. The Republicans have potentially become the party of no climate change, and the Democrats are the party of where they sound exactly like Europeans on this, and are exactly like Europeans on this. So it really makes sense to try to lock in a lot of the changes that the Biden administration wants to do on climate change before the next Republican administration appears, which could be any day now. So I think that that's another important way to do it. And a really effective way to do that would be to sort of make the point that this is something that you can do in cooperation to say that we're going to set the standards that the Chinese are going to have to follow.
So I'm sure, Jean, you want to quickly react. Yes.
I wasn't suggesting that the Chinese would just kindly abide
by
whatever standard we would set. I was saying precisely that it's going to be a tough game for the Chinese and for all of us, precisely for the reason you gave. What I'm saying is that we shouldn't sort of use this climate coalition as the way to rebuild the alliance with the US, and somehow, for reasons that wouldn't have much to do with climate, to leave China aside. Which could be an interpretation. It's not what you said, but you know, some people would look it in this way, saying, "Okay, let's lock in the alliance with the US around climate, and let's sort of decouple from China on climate also." And I don't think that's what we're suggesting. I think it should be the climate coalition should be open to China on reasonable terms, being known that China is a developing economy that it has to get serious about reducing emission, not only in words, but also in acts. This has implication for using coal, for example, a very concrete implication. But to the extent China is willing to enter to some serious commitments, it should be welcome.
Yeah, indeed. And I would say a climate coalition excluding China, of course, would also be highly problematic because China is the biggest emitter at the moment. So clearly we need to bring in China, but we need to lock them in. And I think, Jeremy, your point is exactly right. There need to be strong verification mechanisms so as to lock in the progress, as we have to have strong mechanisms to lock in the US administration. Because the US administration, as you point out, can also change. And then all of a sudden we have climate deniers again in the White House. But I let Simone perhaps give the last word. And perhaps you want to say something also on this Carbon Border Adjustment Climate Club, because we are having an additional paper in which we discuss that in some more detail, Simone.
Certainly, we have been really seeing clearly that for China, the potential introduction of carbon border adjustment measures jointly by the European Union and the United States would really prove to be a formidable incentive to move on climate action. Let me say that we certainly welcome the commitment of China to reach carbon neutrality by 2060, but we need to outline that we still don't know the details. We still don't know what will be in the new 5 years plan. We still don't have the Chinese new pledge for the Paris Agreement that has to be presented soon for the COP26. So we only have an overall target and a general ambition, but we don't have details. And we don't know if China is really serious about this. We see investments happening in coal-fired power generation, both in China and outside of China, by Chinese companies, and this is not reassuring. So probably using the carbon border adjustment measure by the EU and the US jointly could really be the tool to make sure that China is committed, because China certainly doesn't want to see these tariffs to be applied by its basically two major export markets. And to conclude, let me just say that 2021 is the year of action, because it is the first time that we will present the revised pledges under the Paris Agreement, and that will be the strategy for the next 5 years. Therefore, this is really the year of action on climate.
So I'm afraid our time is coming to an end, and let me thank all of our speakers, but let me thank all of our listeners for being with us today. And please do visit our website and find the paper. The paper is co-authored by Mark Lennart, Jeremy Shapiro from European Council on Foreign Relations, and Simone Tagliapetta, Jean Pisani-Ferry, and myself from Bruegel. And I think it's a great paper, obviously. So please come and download the paper and have a look at it. Thank you for joining. And until next time, bye-bye.